You are listening to the Backstage Pass podcast, hosted by Hannah Trigwell and sponsored by Tome.
Hello, Warren Hewitt. How are you?
I am rather well, Miss Hannah Trigwell.
We pronounced each other's names perfectly then. No issues whatsoever.
Good. I thought I would try because, you know, you made the effort as well. But like, you know, we were saying off camera, I'm not too worried if somebody messes up my name. You know, it's, I'm not, being English, I don't even say my own name right. You know, anybody that has a name that comes from another country hundreds of years ago.
Tomato, tomato, you know.
Exactly.
So I wanted to ask you right at the beginning, how did you, this is a very wide open question, but how did you first get into music?
Yeah, there's probably about five ways of interpreting that, because I feel like for me, and I've told this story a few times, so if anybody's listened to this and hears it, I apologize, but my dad, when I was really young, like little, bought me Queen, A Night at the Opera. And that was a big deal because my father was a painter and a sculptor. And so the house was all full of art and paintings and stuff. And the only music that was played constantly was being played was classical music with some jazz. So him giving me a rock and roll album, a rock album when I was little, I mean like little, is pretty crazy. And I remember quite vividly, he gave it to me for Christmas. We weren't a particularly wealthy family. We grew up in a very nice area, but we didn't, you know, having an artist father, wasn't a great deal of money, but it was, you know, he gave me this record and he said, this is worthy. Like, it's okay to listen to this. And so it sort of set it up, you know, I was at that point in my life when, you know, when you're a little kid and your parents are everything and everything yeah. they say is correct, you know, it doesn't last very long as we know. But at that period, it still was there. And I just listened to it. I remember doing that thing you do when you first discover music. I don't know if you're old enough to have been into vinyl or you've come back to vinyl, but
I'm coming back to it. I think I didn't experience it a lot when I was younger, but obviously it's making a revival right now.
Right. Well, the old days of vinyl was, you know, you would put side one on if you're a fan, I suppose, or if you were in love with the record, and you would listen to the side one maybe for 2 weeks. You've probably heard people tell that when they were obsessed about records. So you'd only listen to side one. And for like 2 weeks, you'd just be obsessed with it. And you'd be reading all the liner notes and reading everything. And then you'd flip it over and listen to side two. And then do that for a week or two. And then go back to side one and go, oh, God, I forgot how good this was. And that was that first record. So it's definitely a loaded question because probably the correct way to answer it would have been to talk about playing guitar and playing in bands. But I feel like that is the real essence of the answer to that question because yeah. that is what got me obsessed with music. Now, I didn't actually learn to play guitar for the longest time. I didn't get a guitar until I was 15 and that was the first time I ever played it. And that was actually, I built that. I didn't. My dad built it with my help, meaning he built
wow.
it and I've sanded off some stuff. And of course, it was completely driven by that idea of building a guitar with, you know, like Brian May did with his father.
That's amazing. That must have taken him ages.
I think it took him like a month or two. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, do you still have it?
That's a long story. I know where it is, but I don't currently have it in my possession.
Right. That's what I say about most of the things that I own. So were you a guitarist first and then did you play in a band or were you an artist?
Oh, yeah, I was in loads of bands. Yeah, I played guitar, although I actually, the first success I had, proper success I had, was as a bass player. Because when I was playing guitar as a little kid, you know, 15, 16, sorry if anybody's watching, I didn't mean 15, 16 as a little kid, but when I first started playing, what I mean is, you know, I was really into like being great at guitar, you know, so it was all sort of, you know, very, you know, shreddy kind of stuff.
Nice.
Well, then rolls in the 90s and being really good at shredding and all that kind of stuff and sweep picking and everything is not hip. You know what I mean? Everything was Nirvana and, you know, all of that kind of stuff, which is great. You know, those bands were amazing and I'm a fan of all of them, but, you know, being really good at guitar was not really an attribute. You know, you sort of had to hold. And so a friend of mine, Pat Channon, who I was just chatting with on WhatsApp earlier, was in a band called The Sundays. I don't know if you remember The Sundays. And we grew up together. And he had joined this new band with an American girl singer. And he said to me, oh, we need a bass player. Do you fancy playing bass? And I was like, sure. So he lent me this bass. And I believe it was one of Phil Lynott's old basses. Long story. Thin Lizzy, Phil Lynott. So he lent me this bass. And I went and auditioned. And instead of being Mr. Shred, you know, and coming in and being like, you know, yeah, doing all kind of clever stuff, I literally was just like... and just played downbeat, root notes, and I got the gig.
Brilliant.
I got the gig. They auditioned a bunch of bass players, and I got the gig. And I think that, and we had some success. We had one single or two singles in the charts back in the mid-90s. The band was called Star 69, for anybody who wants to look that up and have a laugh. I had bleached blonde hair, and it was the mid-90s. And
no regrets.
But I don't, no regrets. And I'd already been in, I'd already had a studio, you know, I'd already recorded bands, I'd already been in bands, but that was like the first proper like success. You know, we had a couple of chart songs, and then we came to America to do the album, and we worked with this amazing producer engineer called Don Smith, who was amazing. He had done all the Tom Petty stuff after Shelly Akers stopped working with them. He started working with them, and he'd done the Traveling Wilburys. But I think the reason why we liked him, that was all good, but we liked him because he did this album with Camper Van Beethoven's guys outside of a studio. So they'd found a, and this is all distant memory, but they'd found a barn, and he just rolled in a tape machine, you know, built, put in a console, wired it all up, made a record in a barn.
Amazing.
And so I was like, the guy's discography was amazing. He'd worked with all these incredible artists. He'd done a Stones record. He'd done the Keith Richards solo records. He'd done all these wonderful things. But what I loved about it was that DIY mentality, because that's yeah. sort of how I feel. You know, I feel like, you know, I always say to people, I feel like a, you know, a Les Paul Jr. or a melody maker. I'm not a guy that plays, you know, pearl inlay bound, you know, ebony yeah. fretboard, mahogany, 18 switches, beautifully inlaid, $10,000 guitar. I'm the sort of functional Telecaster off the rack. You know, I go to stores, like if I was in Tyman buying a guitar, I'd walk in, I'd probably go to like the most simplest looking guitar and then try 100 of them like that. And some, I probably might even walk out with the cheapest just because I like the way the neck feels or something. And mm-hmm. and so everything about Don Smith was that. Everything was just like, I just made it happen. So I was just so excited. Just like, this is the guy after our own heart. And he was. He turned out to be fantastic. He was the first guy I ever worked with that had like a Neve console. He had like a little Neve console. And a Fairchild, and these were like mystical things, you know, like because they cost so much money, and it was a lot of fun.
When you first work with someone that has a lot of like really good kit, it does make an impression, though. I mean, I know a lot of stuff's like in the box now and everything, but I know when I first walked into like a big shiny studio, I was like, whoa, this anything I do in here is gonna sound incredible.
Yeah,
which isn't always the case.
No, definitely not the case, but I know what you mean. Do you remember that? Do you remember that first time that you heard like proper compression on your vocals?
Yeah, because I'd never actually heard what it really did. I think like I kind of knew what it did, and I'd listened to like AB stuff in like some all right headphones. But when I heard a really solid compression through amazing speakers, I was like, oh. This is it. This is what it does.
I remember, so we started our record like immediately. We did pre-production for just a few days with the drummer, but we had this, we had Brian McLeod playing drums, and people should look him up. In America, people can't pronounce his name. So if the Americans are listening, it's like Mac Leod.
Oh, is
MacLeod.
That how, yeah, is that how they say it?
Yeah, they say Mr. MacLeod. Yeah, he always jokes about it. He is American, but he says he always has to explain to him how to pronounce Scottish names. But anyway, Mr. MacLeod, Brian MacLeod, is incredible drummer. He had just done the Tuesday Night Music Club first album. He was in the band, you know. He'd written a lot of those songs. I think he wrote If It Makes You Happy with Sheryl Crow and stuff.
Wow.
So he's supremely talented. And I just remember the excitement of like having, I had a bass. I had a really nice one, a Music Man, but Don Smith goes, try this P bass out. And he gives me this like vintage P bass. We have an Ampeg set up, all mic'd up, ready to go. And it's just, the tone is just phenomenal. And that compression, I remember just hitting that and going, bang. I'm just being like, what happened? Where did that come from? And he just had everything set right. So there was no like little brittle attack. It was just singing. And you're just sitting there in a room, you know, headphones on, this world-class drummer that you're just a couple of feet away from, and you've never, you know, no social distancing then. You know, just a few feet away from, and yeah. And it was just feeling like in that room. And I'd recorded, and don't get me wrong, I recorded with my my friend Patch. He's a world-class drummer, played with the Sundays, sold millions of records. So I'd done it, but Brian MacLeod was like...
otherworldly.
Oh, yeah. I remember we did this song called I'm Selfish, and it was rocking, and the whole... We started off with a click, and then we dropped the click, and then let the band go for it. And I remember we played him the demo through the speakers, and he listened and he didn't make any notes. And then we went in and recorded it one time. And he's like, can we go and check it out? And we go back and check it out. And we're all sitting there playing it back through the speakers. And we're all looking at each other like, could this be any better? I doubt it. And it was his first take. And
wow.
Just that, those, and then there's obviously there was other songs we spent a long time on. Some clicked quick, some didn't, you know,
yeah.
That's the way it all works. And sometimes it wasn't him. I was like, I was not hitting it properly, and the new drummer was outdoing me. You know, it's just that feeling of being in a studio for the first time with great musicians, a great engineer, you know, great production, you know, great room, great gear, like you were saying. All of those things are just like, huh.
Yeah, it is magical. How did you go from being like a, you know, a musician, like playing the bass, to a producer?
Well, I always had studios or semblances of studios, you know, whether it be, I've talked about a lot before, you know, two tape decks. Originally, I had, my dad had his Sony stereo, and we had a Philips cassette player. And what I would do is I'd play like a rhythm guitar part, you know, and then, or to be honest, it was always like, when I first started, it was like pentatonic minor blues scales, no understanding what note to bend, no understanding. So it'd be like, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I'd be like, you know, I'd be like, and then I would play it a third up and play the harmony, you know. And but what I would do is I'd take that cassette out, stick it in my parents' hi-fi, play it back through the speakers and play the overdub being recorded on the Philips cassette player. So that was how I started. That's how I learned to record. So it was just two cassettes going backwards and forwards. Of course, by the end of it, you had like this slightly out of tune, bad guitar playing harmony with a lot of hiss in the background. But
you've got to start somewhere.
Exactly. You know, like I said, I don't want to play up the whole fact of being the poor kid, but you know, we didn't have any money. It's funny, we were watching The Bionic Man, $6 Million Man on TV the other day.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, when I was little, this was the show that was on television, and I always wanted a $6 Million Man, and my parents couldn't afford one, so they bought like the cheap knockoff. And it was like slightly smaller and didn't quite look like him, you know, because it was like a third of the price. So I sort of have like the scarring of going to school with my cheap knockoff and all the kids like teasing me, you know, because my parents couldn't afford to buy the real one. But, you know, that sort of reminds me of I don't know. You know, I've used this quote a lot, but the Segovia quote, which I'm totally paraphrasing and is completely wrong, but something where he said all of my good students gave up. And that doesn't mean like, oh, the people that left standing aren't very good. what he was saying, and I'm sure it's a lot, I'm just paraphrasing it, was when things come easily, people give up. So, you know, right. I was saying this in an interview the other day. One of my best friends still plays guitar, but he doesn't do it for a living. But he was the guy that just, he picked up a guitar. And I remember we were into AC/DC and he would just like first week know all the AC/DC songs. He just had a great ear. And yes, they're simple, but we're talking a week of playing guitar and he's already strumming AC/DC songs like straight away. And I got there. But I just had to work harder than him. I had to do 6 hours practice when he used to have to do an hour. And, you know, he still plays and he's still a great guitar player, but he doesn't do it for a living. And he's probably the same guitar player he's been for 20 years, where I keep learning. I still play every day. You know, it's one of the joys doing what we do for a living, doing music, you know, and even all the things like you and I are doing outside of like just recording and writing. Just the ability to be able to like add it all up together as one career is just remarkable. And it takes a lot of being kicked over and bashing into a wall and getting back up again. Yeah. I've pushed against so many walls. Everything I've done in life has been because people won't let me be in their club. So I started my own club, you know? That's sort of how I feel about it. You know, when I was a kid at school, I was very shy, as loud as I am now. I was very shy. Very bookish. I came from a poor family in a wealthy neighborhood, so I didn't know it, but I felt a little less than. And now I'm sure you feel the same way. I just want to create my own playground, you know? I want the people around me. I want the equipment I want. And more importantly, I want the people in my life to be my choices, not pushed on me.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know what I mean? I want to hang out with people I like. If I don't, you know what I mean? You know, I remember, you know, wanting to do video content with somebody, pretty much all of the big names, you know, all of the big people that do it. I was like, hey, we should do some stuff. And they're like, yeah, I don't know. So I just was like, you know what? I'm just going to do it on my own.
Yeah, that's kind of how I got into it as well. I was just like, I really wanted to, I've always loved collaborating. But as you say, sometimes when you get in touch with people that you look up to as a musician, if you look up to them as a musician, they might already be successful, you know, just by the nature of looking up to someone. And yeah, all of those people declined my, please, can we write a song together? Because I was no one of notoriety. So I was just like, oh. Nobody want. Why would anyone want to work with someone that's never released
a song
before? I released them a really bad recording of a really rough song, and it took me a while to get rid of that feeling of, you know, they should like this song. This is a good song. You don't really understand in the beginning. You kind of just think it should just be all about the music, but obviously it's not. And so
yeah, this is a really interesting conversation. We could talk about this for hours because I get a lot of those emails and I listen to every song. And as a producer, as well as a songwriter, but as a producer first, if I put that hat on first, it is my job, and this is a good conversation to talk if we're going to have producers listening to this or potential producers, it is my job to bring out what's great from somebody and exaggerate it and make more of it.
Yeah.
So when you send me a song and I don't know who you are, and let's just say 90% of it is like, oh, no, but there's a piece at the bridge and I'm like, that's a really good melody. Oh, and I love the way the vocal did this or did that. My email back is, yeah, you know, the song needs a lot of work, but go to that second line in the bridge. You see what you did there and you went into a falsetto? It's the only time in the song that you did the falsetto and that's where your voice sounds amazing. Do more of that. And that's my job as a producer. When people are dismissive or whatever, there's lots of reasons. Sometimes it's A, they're too busy. It's interesting because look at this world we're in at the moment, this exact where we're at the moment with what's going on. There's a lot of chickens coming home to roost for that kind of attitude.
Yeah,
there's a lot,
true.
You know what I mean? A lot of guys and girls sitting in their houses going, oh, you know, what, my work's dried up. And it's like, well, you know what? You got to be a receptive, open person and people have got to want to work with you. And I try my darndest to answer everything I possibly can. And it is exhausting. And I do find myself sitting up at 2 o'clock in the morning if I can't sleep, like responding to like every single message that I possibly can. I try to go every form. To me, it's really important that people feel valued in their in what they do. We have a thing called a Produce Like a Pro Academy. And what we do is we do put up a multi-track, sometimes two, sometimes three multi-tracks a month, because we're always giving away stuff. And then we mix critique them. And we listen to them and we make comments. And that is so important to me to do that. Mm. And then all of the people that do what I do and have those kind of stuff all said to me, oh man, you know, how many times do you hear all the digital marketing stuff? You know, that one with the 6-hour work week that everybody likes to talk about? You know that one?
Oh, the four-hour
work week. Oh, it's a four-hour work week? Sorry. Yeah. You know those people?
I mean, I'm not an expert on the book, but I have seen it, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Well, all of those chickens are coming home to roost. You know what I mean? They're all like, yeah. Because all of those guys and girls are all like, yeah, man, you know, you just need to like spend a few hours and film this course, man, and like watch the money come in. And that's really the attitude. It's like, you know, you don't have to work so hard. Everybody said to me, Warren, why do you do all those mixed critiques? Why do you go online? You do so much hard work and all this stuff. I was like, because I want to build a community of people that care about each other, genuinely care and support each other. And if I'm not one of those people, then how's that going to work?
Yeah.
And now I'm watching all of the people that do what I do, trying to do that same thing a little bit too little and too late. You know, it's like, I get this sort of feeling like they're lowering themselves to have to interact with people and all this kind of stuff. And it's unfortunate.
Yeah.
You've got to really care about people. Now, the problem is like, it does get overwhelming. I get 400 to 500 emails a day and I try to find a way of responding to everything in the way I can.
I try to respond to as many people as possible, but even for me, and I don't get that many emails a day, I do find it difficult. I do find it difficult to respond to everybody, but like you were saying before about the course thing, you know, I've seen a lot of people doing things like that and putting it out there and then not doing anything like that ever again, or doing, you know, a really short video series on something, but then not really getting into the comments or, you know, taking feedback on or answering questions. And it just, like, from a viewer's point of view, it just seems like, oh, it's just a business punt, which is fine.
I mean, this,
and I get it from a creator's point of view, but it's not sustainable to do that if you don't really love it, or you don't want to, you know, connect with people that way.
No, I agree. I'm glad you're pointing it out. I agree entirely. I mean, it's a kind of a catch-22, isn't it? Because you find people that are successful at doing those kind of things, but it doesn't always mean you're going to respect them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I know a couple of people that are really, really good at YouTube that do one video a week and get massive numbers and make huge revenue. And they spend the whole week like editing together this perfect video, but then sit in a room with them and give them a guitar and have them write a song. And it's a painful experience, but they know how to make it look, you know what I mean? They're incredible editors. They're scripted and they're perfect. The thing is like Eric and I, this is all we do every day. So when we make a video, it has to be like, well, we've got, you know, he'll tell you, we got 45 minutes to shoot a video and then you've got to edit it tonight to get it up tomorrow. And he drives home and he sits up till midnight editing a video that has to go up today. In fact, it happened last night. What time did I text you? 11? 11, and said, can you put a different, he had to edit an interview on the front of a video because, anyway, it was the only way to give it any kind of good context. So we had to edit that and put it on the front of the video and upload it at 11 o'clock at night. That probably wasn't that much work, but I bet he was still working on it at midnight and on something that we had filmed that same day. And to be honest, I still think the quality's there because this is what I do for a living. There's a difference. Mm-hmm. You can either do a lot of content, because this is what you do and you show what you do. Or you can be completely clueless and not know anything about it, but spend a week doing one video and it'll come out absolutely amazing. It's a very interesting sort of world that we're navigating.
I remember going to like make a video about it's really funny actually, a few years ago, going to make a video about playing bass, and I didn't play bass. And I was thinking, you know, of videos that I could make. And I just had, I wasn't thinking about it properly in terms of, like you say, just documenting what I do is now the kind of rhythm that I'm in, and it works way better for me because it's just normal and natural. But I was like, oh, what kind of video can I make? I haven't done anything with bass. Let's play bass. This is how you play bass. And I remember just sitting down about to do it thinking, I can't even really play bass very well. Like, what am I doing?
How did the video come out?
Oh, it didn't come out.
You didn't put it out or it didn't come out very well?
No, it didn't even begin because I had at least some insight before I even started doing the thing. I was like, I'm thinking about this completely the wrong way. What do I actually want from this action? And I realized that what I wanted is for people to go through the video and listen to my original music, which just made no sense that I was doing this other random thing that I didn't even know anything about.
Well, I mean, that's the navigation of it, isn't it? You're sort of, you really hit the nail on the head. But lots of people wouldn't say, no, this isn't going to work. They would just do it anyway. Lots of people, you know, there's some successful YouTubers and I watch some of their videos and I see their progression as they're learning how to do the job they're teaching, which they don't really know how to do yet. You see them sort of evolve and make all the mistakes that people make while learning how to mix a song or record a song or write a song, but they're presenting it as you know, experts. That's one of the things why I'm really afraid of the word expert. You know, if you've ever watched any of my videos, I usually at least some point kind of make a joke about being not being an expert, and you know, that's a little terrifying to me because the experts are always the ones that tell you you're doing it wrong. You know, you know, I'm sure you felt like that when you're sending songs to people, like, oh my God, this person's an expert and they're going to tell me whether I'm good or bad. And the reality is the best songs ever written were written by people, teenagers, early 20s. Yeah, there's some older people as well. It's not an age thing. My point is like experience is great, but it's not a precursor for something being amazing. There are people teaching how to make money at music that have never made money at music.
Yeah,
there's courses all the time.
I find that kind of thing really worrying as well, because
right, but they're successful.
They are, yeah, they are. Yeah.
But how to grow your business that I don't actually personally have, but I'm going to teach you how to grow it.
It's just crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
And there are a lot of people doing things like that online. I mean, just the introduction of the internet has made everything so much more possible and accessible for people who aren't necessarily funded by like a major label, if you're talking about an artist, or like a major publisher, if you're a songwriter or a producer. But the amazing thing is that technology has advanced so much and is so much cheaper. From like a producer's point of view, if we're just talking about plugins, it's incredible what you can do now with not a great budget, but choosing like the right plugins for the right kind of action. Have you found that you've moved into digital plugins over analog?
I do both. And I have done both from the beginning. Because I did start, properly recording, you know, early mid 90s is when I first started properly recording stuff, you know, and so I was there right from the machine I had was actually a 1-inch tape machine. We had a studio with an MSR 24, which was a Tascam 1-inch tape machine. And then for my own personal studio, when I came to America in the mid late 90s, I got ADATs. So, you know, I've had all of those kind of transitional. And then when I was doing, you know, my recordings in the 90s, it was still 2-inch tape, even though the beginnings of DAW was around. There was Pro Tools, but there was this sort of, you know, there was a bit of a snobbery about Pro Tools or any DAWs at first from almost all every engineer. They were like, oh, it sounds too brittle. It sounds too... Everybody would always say it sounds too digital, which now I think doesn't really make any sense, because now I think most of us would attribute digital to mean sounds perfect, sounds spotless, sounds, you know. But in those days, it was a put down in the 90s, especially, you know, mid-late 90s as the revolution started to happen in music. It was a put down to just say that it was going to be harsh. It was going to be, you know, wasn't going to sound warm and natural and all of those kind of things. And, you know, which we now know is kind of meaningless because, you know, there are, like you're pointing out, a million plugins to emulate everything. And I think the one thing I like about working, you know, in a digital domain is just the access that it gives us. I mean, I'm surrounded by, you're going to see a bit on the camera, but, you know, I've got an SSL, I've got beautiful speakers, a Focals, a Genelecs, the Kallies, I've got, you know, Poltecs, which are like $4,000 each. I got six of them, you know, wow, all this expensive equipment. But the reality is like when I'm recording outside of a drum kit or a piano in stereo, a bass is maybe a bass amp and a DI. Most of what I do is with one microphone going through one mic pre. And, you know, we've been using a lot, and it's not in the camera shot, but an Audient ID44. And it's just sitting down there. And, you know, that's what we use. We just use a simple, inexpensive interface for 90% of what we do these days. And I've got really, really nice gear, which I use specifically for the sound. Like, I love the BAE mic pres, you know, I've got the 312s and the 1073s and 1028s. I've got, you know, all of this really, really nice gear, but for so much of what we're doing, especially when we're demonstrating gear and stuff, we keep it deliberately dumb and simple, because I'm not any use to people watching my videos if everything is $1 million worth of gear. How can I say to you, you know, hey, Hannah, try out this new microphone, you know, through this, you know, $50,000 worth of gear, which you're never going to have or never need to have, more importantly.
Do you like the UAD stuff?
Yeah, we're moving a lot more into UAD. I've got a whole new computer system down here with all the UAD stuff on it. And it's just, it's going to be
crazy,
exciting.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
It's an amazing time. I think, you know, the technology's going to advance faster and faster as well.
Yep.
And it's just, I can't actually envisage where it's going to go from here, because it just seems like, maybe that's because I'm not a visionary, but it seems like how can it be easier and better than it is now?
No, it's wonderful. So tell me a bit about what you do. You're a singer-songwriter, or you're a producer as well?
Oh, I'm a singer and a songwriter, but I do basic production for me in terms of like demo songs, but I'm not a producer. The kind of things that I look for in terms of like producer tips online, which is how I found you, is fixes for my issues. You know, things that I don't necessarily understand, or I've made an error through recording and I need to fix something. Like, actually recently today, I made quite a big error that you might be able to help me with, actually.
Please.
I had checked the audio for something that I was recording, just spoken word, and everything seemed to be fine. Then I left the room, came back, and I must have moved a wire over an electrical output.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's a bad electrical hum buzz on there.
Yeah, the rule with that is to minimize the amount of contact. So they always say to you, do it at 90 degrees. You probably heard that and probably read it already. But yes, if you lay power cables and audio cables, you know, together with each other, you really increase the likelihood of the noise coming through.
Yeah.
But you also might have
mistake.
RF.
Mistake.
Well, it's pretty, it's not really, it happens all the time, you know, because when you're in a recording studio, that stuff will get discovered, you know, if it's part of the process, but sometimes things move so quickly that things happen. We did an album maybe about 5 years ago with Robert John and the Wreck, at Sunset Sound in one day. We tracked the whole album in a day. And what happened is we were in the middle of middle of track. Yeah, it was like 10 or 12 songs. We did all of the basics there. We ended up, I think we redid the vocals the next day here. And then we mixed here like the next day. So it was like a 2-day project. It was done really, really quickly. And the bass player in the middle of recording, like we did like 2 or 3 takes of each song. I think it was 1 or 2 songs. We were like, that's the one, like on the first take. Sometimes we did 4 takes, you know. But in the middle of one of the songs, like on take 2 or 3, the bass player changes his bass. So he mutes. And I was probably talking to the drummer or the guitar player about a sound or a part or something. So he mutes the, you know, his amp, probably puts into the tuner on, changes his bass, plugs in, and we go into another take. So I missed it. I didn't notice that had happened.
Okay.
It shouldn't really matter, except, of course, when he changed the bass, he changed to an active bass, and it was putting out like a crap ton more volume. So what happened? The DI goes into square waves 4 or 5 times during the whole recording because, you know, sometimes you just hit too hard. The output's now so high, it goes... And I give that multi-track out because, of course, that happened to be the take. That was the take. So you have 1 of 2 choices, and that's just real life.
Yeah.
And so whatever, I look out through the window. I'm like, oh, it's a freaking different bass. It's active, you know. And I'm like, okay, I'm not going to turn it down during the take because I'll never be able to rematch the gain. And then, of course, we finish, we solve it, we do another take. But the one we love is the one that has the distortion on it.
You've got to have the best feel versus the best quality. Definitely. I agree there.
I remember being a kid and like taking a 1-4-5, you know. And then learning about the 3 minor chord. And going, wow, I could just rewrite my song. And then, of course, you learn about the 2 minor. And then one day, you go, you hear like a Weezer song, and Rivers makes the 2 minor a major chord. You get... And you're like, it's genius. I'm going to put that in one of my songs. And it's just like, or Kurt Cobain. Do you think Kurt Cobain was going, well, you know, you see, I'm using the Phrygian Lydian over the so-and-so. When he went a 1-4 kind of dumb thing and then moved it up a minor third, he didn't say any of those words I just said.
Yeah.
He did not go, I'm doing a 1-4 and I'm going to move it up a minor third, 1-4. He just went.
But what if he did, though? What if he did? My brain's just not in that area for music at all. I'm not trained. And so when I've taught myself to play guitar, it's been very much tablature as opposed to like genuinely for the majority of chords that I play, I couldn't tell you what they are, which sometimes is a bit of an issue, to be honest.
I know what you mean, but it's individuality. What was great, what's good and what's bad about everything? It's all about balance. Now we have access to everything. And that's amazing that I can go online and be like, how the heck do I need, because I might be playing a song and I'm playing it wrong my whole life. And then because I'm putting the wrong note in or I'm pushing on the wrong beat or I'm playing the wrong chord, I'm thinking it's an A
but
minor.
Then it's actually, version, right?
But that's the point. When all the people that we, let's just sort of take like classic guitar players for a second. Everybody knows, you know, everybody uses the same players and we're all fans of them. Everybody is a fan of these guys, these dudes, these men from Britain in the mid 60s. Let's be honest. It's the same ones and they're all amazing. Eric Clapton, Jimmy Page, Jeff Beck, you know, Peter Green, everybody uses those catchphrases and they're all absolutely phenomenal. All of them learned how to play by beg, borrowing, or stealing like 7 inches or albums that they would get, you know, from blues artists from America, and then they would interpret it themselves. And then they probably, I do know that Jimmy Page and Jeff Beck and a lot of those South London guys knew each other. So they probably all swapped riffs and sat around and you played me a riff and I interpreted your riff and did my version. And then we listened to a record. And it means that when you listen to a record of that period, or even now, those players, and you go, oh, that's Jimmy Page playing guitar. Oh, that's Jeff Beck. I mean, but now, let's be honest, you put on and listen to You just don't know which person is playing the shred fest. Where's the... And again, I don't mind technical. I love technical playing. Mm. You know, I absolutely love technique. I love it all. I mean, I love all that stuff. The thing is like, I think we're just in that sort of bubble at the moment where there's just this massive influx of everything being about technical and overanalyzing everything. And like every
cyclical.
Thank you. I'm ready. It's not that early, but obviously I need another cup of tea. Got my PG tips going.
PG oh, where's your Yorkshire tea, you know? Come
well,
on.
Well, you know, I'm
you're getting what you can get out of
there. Mamby-pamby southerners. I'm a mamby-pamby southerner, that's why.
So if I just briefly go back to that, the electrical buzz thing. If you had like one plugin that you would say, use that, that might be able to get it out, what would you say that would be?
Oh, I think it's, I think Isotope make all of the great fixing plugins, don't they? They're really smart at that stuff. I know Warren Sokol, a mastering engineer friend of mine, was able to remove a foot thump in something that wasn't in time. Sometimes like having that, you know, that kind of, you know, when somebody's boom, 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 can be really cool. But if they're thumping out of time and then... And then you have like other instruments in there, and maybe that thump is just like a little bit too high. It's not like only super low, so you can't just wipe it out. Mm. You know, okay, we'll take 60 hertz out. Oh, it's gone. Yes, that can help sometimes, but sometimes it wasn't. And you know, he used Isotope on one of our tracks once and just literally pinpointed that particular noise that was coming in. It was remarkable.
Wow.
You can see it like a heat map. It basically gives you all the frequencies and you see all of these things and you can just target that particular sound without affecting the other stuff pretty much at all. I've seen miracles, heard miracles, I should say.
It's weird that the guy was like tapping his foot out of time. I actually worked with a producer once who, and this really freaked me out, but we were recording and so I didn't realize until I went in and the guitarist I was working with at the time was recording something, and I saw this this guy and he was moving, you know, to the song like this, but not just not on the beat, not off beat, just in a completely different tempo to the song.
Right.
And I was thinking, he's either a genius or this is going to be awful.
I think you can be in a semi-trance. I remember going to, I had one guitar lesson with a jazz guitar player in England called Esmond Selwyn, who's a really famous jazz guitar player and very, very good. And I remember, I think he was in Wales, and it took me like 2.5 hours to drive to his house for a 1 hour lesson. And I remember it being really expensive. So I couldn't do it more than once. And I remember going there and he was meditating when I arrived. Like I arrived like 45 minutes early. I didn't know how long the drive was going to be. I asked him, I said, so do you meditate? And he's like, yes, I meditate. It helps me be focused. And, you know, when I'm practicing and playing and stuff like that, I'm super focused and you know, gave me a lot of reasons why. And he said, well, how often do you practice? And I was like, you know, at that point I was obsessed. I'm still obsessed, but, you know, there wasn't anything else in my life except for playing guitar. And I was like, I play like 6 to 10 hours a day, depending on, you know, how my hand holds up and all that stuff. And he goes, you don't need to learn meditation. I was like, what do you mean? He goes, you're meditating, you know, because you're just in that zone on your own, just focused in on one task.
Yeah.
And that is, to paraphrase them and be completely wrong. Yeah. So I think sometimes that when people are performing, they get into this like trance-like state and they're in it, but they're not really conscious of it. Now, and then there's other people that are really like in it, and that's great, but that might be a whole different performance. I think if I was Joe Strummer, I was lucky enough to get to work with Joe Strummer just a bit before he died. And with him, it was like everything was deliberate and you believed it. And that was what's so fantastic about it. And when I watch like a metal guy shredding and stuff like that, he's going to be very focused. It's almost like a physical activity. But yeah, maybe somebody strumming some chords, you know, singing a beautiful melody.
It depends on the song, doesn't it?
Yeah, I saw Jeff Buckley, and that was like, first of all, it was like life-changing. Jeff Buckley at Shepherd's Bush Empire, and he was like just kind of a bit like this. He'd like lean in and sing, and he was just kind of lost in it, and it was insane. That was definitely what you were talking about. There was a bit of that.
Yeah.
You know, but it was Jeff Buckley, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if Jeff Buckley does that, it's cool.
It's okay.
It's okay.
Yeah.
Well, we are out of time, but it's been so great to speak to you. Just before we say goodbye, I have two questions.
Yes,
please.
My
first one is, what is your track of the week?
The new Fiona Apple record is absolutely amazing, the whole album.
Yes.
It came out Tuesday, came out on Friday, so I think obviously it's going to be a few weeks later, but yeah, it's phenomenal. All of the reviews that are amazing are all true. It's been reviewed so well. I feel like with Fiona Apple, I remember when Tidal came out, it was like a breath of fresh air, made no sense with the scene at the time, which was so grunge orientated. This girl comes out, she's 17, 18, 19 years old. I can't remember how old she was, like 18, I think, when she did the album. She comes out, it's completely left of center. Everything about it was different from what was current. It was an amazing album of, like, it moved from like a singer that was just empowered at such a young age to extreme vulnerability, everything in between. It was like what you want from an artist. And then I felt like she had a period where it started to feel like the other people who she was working with were more vocal than she was. I liked the Porn album, but it did sort of feel like a John Bryan solo record that she was singing on. I know producer friends of mine love that record because of the sonic landscape. And now I feel like this new album is Tidal again. It's like it's just coming out like swinging for the fences, as Americans would say. It's like all about her. It doesn't feel like anybody. I mean, she's got her band playing on it, so she's in control.
And what is the best lesson that you've learned in your career so far?
I think what we've been intimating in our conversation, which is treat everybody the same. You know, there's nothing worse than when you're working with somebody who either is at two extremes and you pandy to it. So either they're completely new and you, like you said, you've experienced people who are dismissive with you at first. You know, so being dismissive of somebody that's new, or the opposite and just as bad, like walking around on like tender hooks being like, oh my God, you're so amazing. You've got to be yourself. You've got to be yourself. The way we're talking to each other here is how Eric and I talk. It's how I talk to everybody. You've got to learn, and it takes time. You just got to be comfortable enough in yourself to be yourself. And then people either, maybe they won't like you, maybe they will. But the reality is that you won't have to have this pretension and play these games of trying to be like the, you know, oh my God, I'm going to treat this person with deference because they're famous. It doesn't work. Because when you work with a big artist, and you're pandying to them, they see it because they're surrounded by sycophants going, oh my God, you're amazing, like all the time. They don't want that. They want to be in a room with somebody who treats them like an equal and tells them when they did something great and tells them also when they did something crap. And that is the way to be. So, yeah, it's sort of a life lesson in everything. You know, grow into yourself and just have the confidence in your own ability. If somebody puts you in a room and they want to work with you, that's 99% of the battle has already been won. So just be like, okay, this person asked to write a song with me. This person wanted to work with me. Okay. I don't have to be quite so terrified and afraid. You know, as that old phrase that's been around for a billion years, you know, 99% of the job is just showing up. So if you can own that and realize that really is the truth, then you can walk into every situation with enough confidence to just be yourself. And that's the biggest thing you can do.
Amazing. Thanks so much for speaking to me today.
Thank you. It was marvellous. Ms. Trigwell.
It's been great to talk to you.